So, yeah, it's not so much of an interview. It's just sort of some questions to get to know you and sort of learn a little bit more about your professional background. So we don't grill too hard.
And when I was reading through these questions, I felt like at least some of it was covered this morning. I don't know if you guys...
Yeah, there may be some things that...
So we might direct it to maybe some of the topics that we're interested in as well. But definitely we want to build on what we heard this morning to learn more about your work and your scholarship.
Sound good? All right. Here we go. So actually, Matt and I had a discussion about this first question. The question is, how did you get into literacy studies? And what we were talking about was, is literacy studies the apt thing to call it? You have, you know, your expertise in semiotics, in education, linguistics. So how did you get to where you are now in your scholarship?
Literacy studies. I have in England, I have a sort of slight or maybe notorious reputation for not liking the term.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly not liking the term when it's kind of spread to cover all sorts of things. The reason for that, before I ask you a question, is that if one is attempting to persuade politicians that they should be attending to all sorts of other things, or one is attempting to get money, fair enough, let's use the term that everybody seemingly understands. If we want actually to understand how representation functions, then the term, like most names, the name tends to suggest you know what is being named, which usually isn't the case. So it's a kind of an obstacle to people kind of attempting to understand forms of representation other than, let's say, the written or the spoken. I got into an interest in writing because of seeing my children learn to write. The first two made me realize that there's something which is not understood, or rather there are two things which aren't understood. The first is the learning of writing is actually in societies or cultures like our English-speaking cultures, very much like the learning of a new representational system, maybe not quite like learning a new different language, a fundamentally different language. That was one thing, and I wanted to understand what that was about. But the second thing was that in 1978 I went back from England to Australia, and the only job that I, was in a teacher's college, which had to turn itself into a multi-purpose institution, otherwise it was going to be closed down. And I was brought in to kind of change this college into a multi-purpose institution. But while I was doing that, I thought I would like to do some teaching, and I discovered, that all the emphasis in teacher education was on reading, with some really bizarre theories around. But the other thing was, and that was more bothering to me, that children's learning to write was always talked about in terms of insufficiency. So what children did was never what adults maybe could do and thought children should be able to do or should move towards, rather than saying something which I think in a way both comes from Chomsky and from Halliday, that children do what we do, namely they represent the world as they see it with the means they have for representing it, which is a very different kind of thing. So for instance, when I represent the world in France by speaking French, I have roughly perhaps 500 or 600 lexical items, and in enormously limited syntax, and with that I have to kind of represent the world of France to other French people. But I think that's actually not unlike all of us. I think we can only use the means we have. We have a position in the world, and from that position we see the world and represent the world. And children are like that. Now, Chomsky's position was a bit that when he talked about children learning language, he talked about them having successively new formulations, new accounts, new hypotheses about the grammar of the language they were learning. So what they were doing was never insufficient, but it was always a speculation about what the grammar of this entity actually is. And in as far as we never stop learning language, we continue doing that all the time. But I think the Hallidayan position and the Chomsky position each, in a sense, gives a dignity to the person who is doing this representing, and also says what they're doing is like us. And of course it moves the emphasis away from reading, which was regarded as a passive skill, which of course it isn't, and towards writing, which is what's regarded as an active skill. So that was really it. And I thought I would like to write something which kind of clearly said that children, for instance, children write something. They have initially no notion of the sentence because all they have is the kind of notion of the textual units which come from speech. And with that, they attempt to understand what a sentence is. The teacher makes corrections. The children don't quite know what they are, nor does the teacher know what the unit was that the children wanted to make. But sometimes the children make corrections too, or rather alterations. I mean, the notion of error in there is sort of one I wanted to get away from. The children make alterations, and you see that they've actually thought about what a sentence might be. And successively, they work their way into the notion of a sentence as a meaningful unit, a meaningful and a syntactic unit. And when you attempt to do that, you see intelligent people at work. So that was my start. And from then, I got interested in the problem that existed in Australia in the 80s, which was a lot of immigrant, a big immigrant population, and some people whose English wasn't kind of good enough in a way to help them or make them succeed at university. So, in a sense, again, the same sort of issue. What are the things that somebody needs to have by way of resources, or Aboriginal populations, or for that matter, lower class? White Australians, what is it somebody needs in order to be successful in this community, which is now being picked up a lot? I mean, Jim G's notion of discourse is exactly like that. And so those were my interests. And then, as I said this morning, I got interested in the issue of genre, which at that time wasn't being talked about. I wrote about genre in this book, Learning to Write in 1978, which was... afterwards, exactly the same time as who's the Frenchman who wrote La Langue du Genre and Derrida. So genre somehow was in the air. It was about the notion of genre. And of course it was about because that was just about the time when the stability of genre definitively came into crisis because social changes made it impossible to have stable genres. That's broadly it. And then I suppose when I came to England first in 1991, I went there as professor of English in relation to schools. And so my task was to think about English and what that might be and what the function of English might be. And there I had two ideas. On the one hand, to say, how should young people be? What kinds of resources should they have for them to be kind of effective and able to kind of implement their own desires when they entered society? That was partly then the multimodal kind of issue. But also, of course, there was a huge debate about literacy. Really, I was dragged in by my Australian friends into the New London group because of the work I had done previously to Australia.
So, you mentioned Halliday and you mentioned Chomsky, but who are the other folks that sort of formed and influenced your thinking as you developed, or as you sort of moved from the transformational linguistics to, I guess, if you would consider yourself a literacy studies person now, multimodal social semiotics?
Really, I think Chomsky and Halliday were the two, for me, forming influences. I didn't, in fact, other than the notion of Chomsky's misconceived in my own mind, notion of the this innate linguistic capability, but nevertheless his idea that their children constantly reformulate the hypothesis of language, that seemed to me fine, and that in a sense corresponds with his politics. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really a positive thing about Chomsky. But Halliday and Chomsky were it. Obviously I've come across other people, but I hadn't read in the Anthropology of Literacy. I hadn't met Bryan Street by then, some graphic approaches. I was pretty ignorant, and I think because I've moved from disciplinary place to disciplinary place, I've always appeared ignorantly in a new place. and in a way, it gives you a lot of freedom. You know, you're not kind of bound to things that people have thought for a long time, and you're not forced into attempting to knock somebody else down in order to kind of establish your, you know, you just say something. So literacy for me, that was it. I thought I knew what the thing is about. The very strong notion of the social being prior is, of course, a Marxist notion for me, that it's the social which forms the superstructural, the social and economic basis which forms the superstructural. And really, beyond that, I didn't think I needed much more, but I still don't. And, of course, which isn't to say that, you know, ethnographers have their way of looking and anthropologists have their way of looking, psychologists have their way of looking, and that one should in any way kind of dismiss them, but that's not what I was doing.
What about your life experiences and how they shaped your thinking as a scholar? Maybe if you could select one or two examples. Obviously, that's a broad question. I know this morning you talked about...
Nothing too intimate.
This morning you talked about your apprenticeship,
yeah.
And how that work,
yeah,
informs your scholarship.
Yeah.
Any other significant life experiences that have impacted your thinking as a scholar?
Well, somebody this morning... talked about different societies and different cultures and their incommensurability.
Mm-hmm.
And having been dragged unwillingly to Australia as a 16-year-old, as a 16-year-old, you tend to be interested, if you're heterosexual, in the other sex. So I left a girlfriend behind and sort of had an attempt to establish relations with the other sex is a 16-year-old, and found out very quickly that there are quite specific cultural rules about that, or social rules about that, and that these are very specific, and I didn't know them. And
very problematic.
Very problematic. I mean, I was lucky because where I worked, there was somebody who was an Australian man, 28, I thought he was very old, I was 16, who invited me to one of the party in Australia. They had these sort of big wooden sheds, sort of where you have local kind of meetings and dances and whatever, probably the same in America.
Mm-hmm.
I went there, and this was my first experience of this kind of event. And in this big shed, at this end, there were the men with a keg of beer. And then that end, there were the women. And in between there was a big open space with nobody in it. And I sort of I saw there was women over there, including some young women, so I strolled over there, only to be kind of accosted about an hour later by a young man a bit older than me saying, "You used to talk to my girlfriend." and invited me to come outside. So
sounds like a movie.
It's that kind of experience. But learning language with learning a culture, and that was what the person this morning was asking about, how do you get from this culture and its formulations, its kind of making its naming of its significant things to this culture, and its different naming of different kinds of significant things. So becoming bicultural and bilingual was for me an enormously important. It just simply made it beyond question that these things, that representation and the social, are utterly connected. And then I suppose when I later on had gone back to England, or rather had gone to England, hadn't been to England before, and sort of becoming politically conscious and, in the early 70s when people at universities, in England anyway, had Marxist reading groups, and I sort of fell into the Marxist reading group. And while they were talking about literature and the formation of literature and its relation to the social and economic background, I thought, well, actually, this applies to language. And so with a friend, Bob Hodge, with whom I co-taught, another friend, Tony True, with whom I co-taught, began to develop means of looking with the linguistic means we had, like transformation or particular kinds of transformations like nominalization or making of complex sentences, began to look at how power is actually expressed in linguistic form. Why is it that English has the kind of possessive forms that it has, which are unlike those in other languages, alienable, inalienable, positioned very differently. And we read a book called Language's Ideology, which is usually misquoted as language and ideology, but we wanted to say that language is in itself the concretization over long, long periods of the social organization of particular communities. So I think it's both those things, becoming politically conscious and having this experience of moving into a different culture with its different language and the connectedness of these things that I think has never. So that's exactly what I do now. And so when I now talk about the motivated sign rather than the arbitrary sign, it's simply that expression. In fact, I wrote the first article on that in 1977 because it seemed to me implausible. The Saussurean notion of the sign, not the Persian notion of the sign, in which the interpretant is, of course, something which a person makes from their experience of an encounter with the sign.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We talked a little bit about this at lunch, but we'd just like to know a little bit about your experiences as a teacher, what classes you've taught. I know you're not teaching right now, but what classes you've taught in the past that you enjoyed teaching and why they were your favorites, why you enjoyed them.
I never taught in school.
No.
I don't find it a particular problem. I mean, my colleagues, being in an institute which is pedagogic institution. But I did teach from the age of 26 in universities. My first proper teaching job was as a lecturer at a German university. One of my teachers in Australia said, if you want, after I graduate, I could get you a job as a lecturer with my former professor in Germany. And he said, yeah, one. So here I was, because a lecturer in Europe is somebody who is a native speaker of a language and teaches that in another place. So I was there as a native speaker of Australian, I suppose, teaching Australian. That was my first teaching job. And then I went to England. I had a job as a research fellow and a lecturer in applied linguistics. And again, there was a challenge because it was exactly the time when the newer reel-to-reel tape recorder had become sort of popularly available. And as every technology, it's always seen as kind of the answer to the problems that hadn't been solved before. And so there used to be these language centers where sort of cubicles and cubicles of people kind of somebody at the front, a very traditional classroom, except with the sort of the trappings of contemporary technology. But they were hearing language and speaking language in order to gain reading competence. And I thought, that's a bit strange. So the Halliday notion of the distinction of speech and writing had already sort of been about for me a bit. So that was strange, but the other thing that was strange was, of course, if you speak English as your first language and then you learn German, what you encounter is an entirely different syntactic organization. And German sentences are simply, a man called, I think, Miller, psychologist, talked about left branching and right branching structures in languages. German is enormously left branching, that is, it says an endless number of things before before it comes to the resolution of a sentence, which of course trains you in certain kinds of memory. You have to just store these things up and make kind of hypotheses about how the sentence is going to end. Whereas in English, you have these kind of sequential, so it's a kind of a paratactic structure, sort of simple entities normally linked to simple entities in a long sequence. I mean, it's an oversimplification. Whereas German is hypertactic, English right branching, German left branching, and I thought really one should find means of bridging for an English speaker the path to the very difficult structure of German. So that was interesting. But as somebody this morning said, I think Katie, it was a practical problem, which led me to think about sentence complexity and its effects in language teaching and language learning. And then I moved to East Anglia, and in East Anglia I taught all the other kinds of things like transformational grammar, Halliday linguistics, but also psycholinguistics, sociolinguistics. And for me the real question was, how could one find a kind of a regular account, or an account of the regularity of sociolinguistic variations? And the model at that time, one model was Jakobson's feature analysis. I don't know if you're in any way familiar with the feature analysis of sounds. And somebody said to me, "Is that what you're going to do?" And I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. It seems to me the explanation for linguistic variations, Bob's work on speech and translation, the account for me seems to be power. If you use power as the key to understanding linguistic variety, and that was really then the beginning of the work with some of my colleagues around language and power, with Tony True, who was a philosopher of language, with Bob Hodge, who was a literary person, sort of developing a means of providing accounts of how language is shaped by the social, but by power in the social. That was actually for me crucial, and it hasn't left me. I mean, people now say to me, "Oh, yeah, but you've forgotten about the politics and the event." Well, I haven't forgotten about it. For me, it's sort of it's kind of a rock bottom base. Base kind of assumption that power shapes action and interaction. So that would be my.
If I can ask a question just for clarification, when you are referring to power, are you referring back to that idea of institutional power that you referred to in Foucault's sense? Of discourse shaping the relations, shaping relationships and the social?
Well, power, I think even in Foucault, exists not only in hierarchical organizations but also horizontally, or exists horizontally when it sort of momentarily skews horizontally into the direction of the vertical. But So it would be power from bottom up, in the sense of a refusal
mm-hmm.
Of some kind, a refusal to occupy the position which is coded for you in a genre, or a refusal to kind of carry out a simple task, which you could, of course, you know, you won't. So power actually working in all directions. And then my serious question this morning, and of course, Kay's right, one needs to kind of explore that, that whereas, say, Foucault had assumed that power is at the bottom of social organization, Habermas had assumed, or at least ideally proposed, that the absence of power should be taken as the basis for social organization, and I'm on the side of Foucault. I mean, it's interesting that they're roughly contemporaries. One growing up in France under German occupation, one growing up in Germany with the German oppressors of Europe, and their response to the exercise and the effects of power then being exactly opposite. But
and their publics look much different.
Yes.
Because of it,
yes.
They sort of
exactly.
reflect,
yeah. Yeah.
project and reflect
yeah.
these very different publics.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the next question is on a totally different topic.
Yeah.
and we usually ask it as, what's on your nightstand? Meaning, what do you read for fun, or what do you read in your free time? What do you read before you go to bed, that sort of thing?
All sorts of things. I mean, sometimes I get a bit of a... Somebody gives me a book, and then I read all the things the person has written. Some years ago, it was W.T. Sebald, that I really came across him. A German emigre. In fact, he and I were—I didn't know when I came across him as a novelist. He and I knew him at East Anglia. We were contemporaries there, but I didn't know anything about him as a writer. So that, and of course, of a shared experience of how, born in my case in the war, the beginning of the war. In his case, a little bit later, he was 4 or 5 years younger than I. How do you make sense of? The German kind of well, the madness that overcame part of Germany. Then I've read Günter Grass, and in fact, I meant to quote a little bit from one of his recent books called On Peeling the Onion, in terms of framing. There's sort of a I remain interested in that because I can't write literary stuff. I sort of have a wish that I could. At the moment I'm reading a German sociologist in German, a very, very interesting man called Nick, who's not known in English at all. So
it sounds like your free time reading tends towards German. It's not J.K. Rowling and Graham Greene and sort of well-known British or Australian writers.
Sebald was suggested to me by my daughter in English. She bought me the English version of Rings of Saturn. And after that, I then read all of his stuff in English. He was fortunate in having a very good translator. Günter Grass isn't. But then I think you're right that at the moment I'm sort of wishing, because Anglo-Saxon thinking has been more influenced by French theory than by German theory. And I think it's not, well, of course they're very different, but I think there's a lot in German theorizing which is really interesting. And so I wish I had kind of done that before. But also at the moment I'm reading a book by the man who's more known for his the name escapes me, the person who talks about art, Gombrich, he's written a little book on the history of the world. It's a big book on the history of the world, but it's written for children. And it's a fantastically sort of nice book, not Rowling, because I think as a writer she, she's very close to Dan Brown.
Mm-hmm.
both in terms of success and in terms of skill,
right.
or the absence of. so,
and what was the name of the person that wrote that?
Gombrich, who's
okay.
known for his writings on art.
Mm-hmm.
Art and the Illusion, I think, is one of his famous books. But here he wrote, at the age of 27 and still in Vienna, somebody asked him, they didn't have any money, to write a book on history of art and be for children. And it did. And it's just been republished. And it's a very simple sort of, and thoughtful, a lovely book. So I read kind of a bit like that.
All right.
Sorry, we listed our names with each question and it fell on me and I wasn't ready. the next question is sort of what you would think are some of the most important questions for students or scholars today to be thinking about. For in our program, of course, is rhetoric and composition or writing. What do you think are the most important questions that our field could or should be considering?
Well, I think it is the kind of, I hate the prefix re, and I hate the adjective new.
So yeah, literacy, re, new, okay.
Because everything is now new, kind of based on something or other, it's rethinking, remaking, blah. But multimodality opens a door to considering again a whole range of issues, like the one I mentioned this morning, recognition of the capacities of, or the normal, the everyday normal actions of humans in their interactions. For instance, around assessment, it really opens up. So that seems to me important. It opens a different perspective on writing, because writing will now have to say, are we happy with whatever linguistics is given us of various forms as a description of the resource that we're dealing with. And also the place of writing, I take Kirsty's point this morning, of course there's always been multimodal representation, but the dominant ideologies of being that writing is central, this kind of echo said in one of his more recent books, that it's capable of expressing everything that is human and rational, and I think it ain't. then a complete reassessment of the notion of language. I think there's a huge problem with the notion of language, and also in its metaphoric uses. So people who sign, the community of signing people, have a system which is entirely different to speech or writing. Of course, there has been an enormous amount of work on that now, and that wasn't 30 years ago. But what does one say when one says language is the sine qua non of human nationality? Does one say that signing is exactly like what we understand by language, or do we not care about it? Or when Chomsky says there's an innate language capacity, does he mean there's an innate capacity to make signs? Yeah? And those things actually kind of change how one thinks about who we are, what we are, what we do. So that, for me, is in my little area, is the big question. So the book I'm writing at the moment, or have started on writing, is a book. I thought nobody would kind of take me seriously, but it's a book called Language, because there's Bernard Blue for the language, and there's before him the other kind of German American. All the names go, but it'll come to me in a moment. Also, language, I mean, the greats, you know, how dare you write a book called Language? So it has a subtitle called A Social Semiotic Approach to Something About Meaning. Because I do think that linguistics has done language has kind of limited our understanding of what language is. And so I would like to say, how would a semiotic approach change that? But that's a kind of a local, domestic undertaking.
Okay. Well, this one is sort of a continuation of that question. Where do you see the field of, again, literacy studies, rhetoric and composition going from here?
Well, I think it, I hope I have a few minutes because I'm going to change my presentation for this afternoon.
Of course, yes.
But at the moment, one of the things I'm involved in is the semiotics of the operating theatre. In the operating theatre, you see people who don't talk much, but do a lot. And it raises the whole question of what is called tacit knowledge or implicit knowledge, but isn't. It must be absolutely explicit. Otherwise, every operation would end in disaster, because it's a cooperative practice of a team of people, but also, so what it means is how do we begin to understand meaning-making forms of knowing, the implementation or the sensational forms of knowing beyond, say, the spoken and the written, or the written alone. So apart from the kind of, we must look at image, I think we also need to understand actually the whole range of ways in which humans instantiate knowledge. And one of my friends and not colleagues, but we sort of work a bit together, talks a lot about mimesis as a means of learning. And how can we kind of extend the notion of mimesis to understand why it is that maybe, I don't know, to be precise again, 92% of our knowing comes by mimetic, engagement with the world and transforming of and shaping one's identity. So that's, for me, the field. And people talk about visual rhetoric. There's no reason why the notion of rhetoric as sort of a political an attempt to understand the politics of interaction should be confined to things which are inscribed on surfaces. And I think that would be interesting for people in when a surgical team is assembled, they're also engaged in compositional processes or practices or representational practices. And when the patient is kind of stitched up again, then something has been performed and done. Notions of performance, for instance, of course, you probably use them in the work you do here. So that sort of expanding that field and then seeing when you've done that, and then after 500 years, or maybe just after 20 or 30, that something else will have emerged and probably something richer and more nuanced and more able to appreciate all sorts of things. And when I became a furrier, it was said by the older kind of furriers in the workshop, good furriers born of me. I mean, I heard the same thing in Australia when I was trying to establish a degree in journalism. We had to get people from the profession in for their validator degree, and they said, no, good journalist born of me. And then with a surgeon, so it's a fact, good surgeons are born, not made. As, of course, are writers.
Right.
So, undoing all that stupidity, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of attempting to understand what it is that makes a good writer or the good surgeon, because there are still differences. But there are courses that teach people writing. And there are kind of hospitals where you are taught to become surgeon. So undoing all that sort of covering over of unrecognized knowing. Undoing that.
A tall order. Well, does anyone else have any more questions?
I mean, I've got plenty, but,
yeah.
But we're...
We have to
record the answers to them.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you
very much.
Yeah, for
thank you.
Well, thanks for taking that care and your time.
Oh, our pleasure.
No problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So
again,
I mean, I do have a question. It's not
yeah, as do
interview.
I.